The tradition of sounding the shofar on Yom Kippur is linked to the biblical command to sound the shofar on the Jubilee, in fulfillment of the verse that is emblazoned on the Liberty Bell today: proclaim liberty throughout all the land. Liberty, meanwhile, is what Moshe Segal did not immediately have. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 177, The Call of the Shofar at the Wailing Wall. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It was in 1930 that a unique tradition of Jewish protest began at the Wailing Wall, a tradition that captured the pain of Jerusalem's Jews, their disappointment with what had not been achieved in a decade under the British Mandate, and their yearning for what they truly sought in Jerusalem. This began following a year of terrible Arab attacks on the Jews of Jerusalem and the Holy Land at large, after which the British had limited severely the rituals performed by Jews at the Kotel, and this included a ban on sounding the shofar at the conclusion of Yom Kippur. A young man named Moshe Segal, later a rabbi, decided to blow the shofar anyway, which started the tradition, largely overseen by the Irgun, of recruiting young men to smuggle ram's horns into what was then the narrow alleyway where Jews crowded in order to pray, and conclude the service by illegally sounding the shofar in Jerusalem. The website Rav Kook Torah gives us a translation of Rabbi Segal's recollections from 1930. Quote, "On Yom Kippur of that year, 1930, I was praying at the Kotel. During the brief intermission between the Musaf and Mincha prayers, I overheard people whispering to each other, 'Where will we go to hear the shofar? It will be impossible to blow here. There are as many policemen as there are people praying.' The police commander himself was there to make sure that the Jews will not, God forbid, sound the single blast that indicates the end of the Yom Kippur fast. I listened to these whisperings and thought to myself, can we possibly forego the sounding of the shofar that accompanies our proclamation of God's sovereignty over the world? Can we possibly forego the sounding of the shofar, which symbolizes the redemption of Israel? True, the sounding of the shofar at the close of Yom Kippur is only a custom, but, quote-unquote, a Jewish custom is Torah. I approached Rabbi Yitzchak Horenstein, who served as the rabbi of our, quote-unquote, congregation, and said, 'Give me a shofar.' 'What for?' 'I will blow.' 'What are you talking about? Don't you see the police?' 'I will blow.' The rabbi abruptly turned away from me, but not before he cast a glance at the prayer stand at the left end of the alley. I understood the hint. The shofar is located inside the stand. When the hour of the blowing approached, I walked over to the stand and leaned against it. Surreptitiously, I opened the drawer and slipped the shofar into my shirt. I had the shofar, but what if they saw me before I had a chance to blow it? I was still unmarried at the time and, following the Ashkenazic custom, did not wear a tallit. I turned to a person praying at my side and asked to borrow his tallit. My request must have seemed strange to him, but the Jews are a kind people, especially at the holiest moments of the holiest day. He handed me his tallit without a word. I wrapped myself in the tallit. At that moment, I felt that I had created my own private domain." End quote. As Rabbi Segal recalled, he felt that there, within that tallit, he had freedom. Or as he put it, quote, "Here I am under no dominion save that of my Father in heaven. Here I shall do as he commands me, and no force on earth will stop me." When the closing verses of the Ne'ilah prayer, "Hear, O Israel, blessed be the name, and the Eternal is God," were proclaimed, I took the shofar and blew a long, resounding blast. After that, everything happened very quickly. Many hands grabbed me. I removed the tallit from over my head, and before me stood the police commander who ordered my arrest. I took the shofar and blew a long, resounding blast. After that, everything happened very quickly. Many hands grabbed me. I removed the tallit from over my head, and before me stood the police commander who ordered my arrest." End quote. In this one act, Moshe Segal captured the pain that Jews felt in that moment, but also a clarion call hearkening miracles that were yet to come. We have to proceed our reflection today by recounting how 1929 was a year of horrific violence against the Jews of the Holy Land. At the center of the violence was the Mufti that the British Mandate had appointed. The mob in Jerusalem was incited on the 23rd of August, and the violence and murder from the mob killed Jews in Jerusalem and in Hebron. Simon Sebag Montefiore, in his biography of Jerusalem, summarizes some of the terrible facts in a single sentence. Quote, "In one Jerusalem household, 5 members of the same family were slaughtered. In Hebron, 59 Jews were massacred." End quote. 31 Jews murdered in Jerusalem and 59 in Hebron. The violence and horror was, as many note, part of what led to the formalizing of the Haganah as a defending Jewish army, and soon after that, in the 1930s, the Irgun, bodies created for Jewish defense, a defense whose necessity had been foreseen long before by Jabotinsky. But by the 30s, Jabotinsky would be banned by the British from returning to Mandate Palestine due to his criticism of the British Mandate and his advocating of Jewish defense. Jabotinsky's influence would remain immense, but his absence from the Holy Land would allow for the further increasing of the prominence of David Ben-Gurion, who would form his Mapai political organization in 1930 and become chief of the Jewish Agency's executive in 1935. In 1930, with Herbert Samuel already having left his position as High Commissioner, his actions in the post a disappointment to the Jews of Jerusalem, the small act of Moshe Segal took on a larger symbolism. Menachem Begin, in his book The Revolt, reflected the following, quote, "The dispute over the Wailing Wall and the Old City is probably a reflection of the whole struggle for the ownership of Eretz Israel." And he adds, "Those stones are not silent. They do not cry out. They whisper. They speak softly of the house that once stood here, of kings who knelt here once in prayer, of prophets and seers who here declaimed their message, of heroes who fell here dying, and of how the great flame at once destructive and illuminating was here kindled. This was the house and this the country which, with its seers and kings and fighters, was ours before the British were a nation. The testimony of these stones, sending out their light across the generations." End quote. As I reflected once for Tikva's Jewish Leadership Conference, the paradox of Jerusalem is that despite the testimony of these stones reflecting the Jewish connection to the sacred city, as well as the impact that the Jewish people had on the world, it is just this very whisper, this Jewishness of this city, that empire after empire sought to silence. And we must understand why. To see living Judaism in Jerusalem, to see a young man of a very old people sound one of the most ancient instruments in the world at the Wailing Wall, is to be forced to confront what is for many an uncomfortable truth, that the Jewish people are unlike any other nation. Jerusalem, as Norman Podhoretz once put it, reflects what he called, quote, "the scandal of Jewish particularity," end quote. Meaning, the uniqueness of one city in the history of the world testifies to the enduring nature of one people on earth. Jerusalem proclaims the mystery of Jewish eternity, and it is this mystery that many seek to attack. And when we think about it, we realize that the shofar is for the ear what Jerusalem is to the eye. It too resounds with the scandal of Jewish particularity. For consider, as I argued, the medieval sage Sadia Gaon hasn't suggested that the shofar is meant to recall the sound of Sinai, where the world was given the Ten Commandments, an enduring impact on the world created by one tiny people that surrounded that site. Both Jerusalem and the shofar reflect Jewish particularity, but also the impact that Judaism had upon the world. Jerusalem and the shofar reflect how the Jews are a small eternal people with a universal message, whose particular connection to Jerusalem has so often been attacked and denied. And there is another striking aspect to this ritual that began in 1930, this protest, this statement of a Jewish connection to a sacred city and a holy land against the ban of the British on the very sounding of that shofar. The tradition of sounding the shofar on Yom Kippur is linked to the biblical command to sound the shofar on the Jubilee in fulfillment of the verse that is emblazoned on the Liberty Bell today. Proclaim liberty throughout all the land. Liberty, meanwhile, is what Moshe Segal did not immediately have. He continues his recollection, quote, "I was taken to the Kishle, the prison in the old city, and an Arab policeman was appointed to watch over me. Many hours passed, but I was given no food or water to break my fast. At midnight, the policeman received an order to release me, and he let me out without a word. As I exited the gate, I met a group of young men from Yeshivat Merkaz Arav, the Jerusalem yeshiva founded by Rav Kook. My friends, I called out to them, what are you doing here at midnight? They told me that immediately after I blew the shofar, some Merkaz Arav students who had prayed at the Kotel hurried off to tell Rav Kook what had happened. The chief rabbi was happy to hear that someone sounded the shofar at the Kotel, but saddened to hear that I had been arrested. All this took place before Rav Kook had broken his fast. He did not eat, but on the spot called the High Commissioner's secretary, demanding my immediate release. When his request was turned down, Rav Kook informed the secretary that he would not break his fast until I was freed. The High Commissioner resisted for several hours, but finally, out of respect for the chief rabbi, he had no choice but to set me free." End quote. It was only decades later that Rabbi Segal, who had been imprisoned for sounding the shofar in 1930, would experience the true proclaiming of liberty. a wonderful video about the young men that sounded the shofar at the Wailing Wall against the British ban from 1930 to 1947. A video to which we have sent you a link concludes with an interview with the man who in 1947 had been the last to sound the shofar at the Wailing Wall before the Old City fell to the Jordanian Legion. He describes how in 1967, he immediately following the Old City's liberation, went to the Wailing Wall and asked someone that he saw with a shofar if he could borrow the instrument. The man holding the shofar asked why he was so interested in creating this ancient sound. And he replied that he had been the last in 1947 to sound the shofar in defiance of the British ban. The man holding the shofar replied, "Ani hayah harishon. I was the first to sound the shofar, proclaiming Jewish liberty in the sacred city." That was Rav Segal, and the first to sound the shofar in 1930, and the last in 1947, embraced there in 1967. The sound of the shofar is the sound of Jewish history itself. It captures the pain of the past, the longing in the present, and the faith in miracles that are yet to come. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.